Location redacted. It took just over redacted to drive the agency Suburban down to the CIA training facility. Situated on a peninsula, redacted is a secluded redacted training site that had gained notoriety as the rehearsal site for the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. A full mock-up of the compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, had been built so the assault force could memorize the layout of the world's most wanted terrorist's home. The SEALs tasked with completing the mission had been successfully assaulting compounds of every shape and size, year after year, on virtually a nightly basis since 9/11. But the Abbottabad mission would have worldwide geopolitical repercussions, so nothing was spared to stack the deck in their favor. The special operations community is a small one, and though he was older than many of them, Reese recognized a few of the Army commandos from various training schools and deployments. Navy Seabees were hard at work building a mock-up of the lodge on Medney Island for full mission profile rehearsals. Nothing was known about the inside layout, as all they had to go on was satellite imagery, which would ensure the outside was almost an exact replica of the target. 40 assaulters from Redacted had arrived a day earlier and had been preparing for what they had been told was a hostage rescue mission. They had assumed it was for a target in Somalia or Syria and had not yet been told mission specifics. That was about to change. When Reese drove in, most of the assaulters were in the chow hall waiting for an upcoming intelligence briefing. The unit, as it is known by the skilled operators in its ranks, drew heavily from the Army's 75th Ranger Regiment. An entire Ranger element had been killed alongside Reese's troop in Afghanistan 2 years earlier. As Reese sat down with his tray of food, a handful of redacted assaulters, including their troop sergeant major, approached.
"Mr. Reese,"
the large bearded man began, in an accent that betrayed a southern upbringing.
"I'm Christian Holloway, Troop Sergeant Major. I just wanted to thank you. We all knew the boys killed with your troop in Afghanistan, the Rangers on those birds. You did right by them."
One by one, the redacted operators shook Reese's hand.
"Also heard about what you did in Odessa. Sorry to hear about Freddie. I worked with him in 09 in Iraq. Solid as they come. See you in the briefing,"
Holloway said with a respectful nod. Reese stood at the back of the stadium-style briefing room and wondered if this was the same room where his friends had first received word that the UBL mission was a go. The assaulters and a few support personnel filled the first four rows of seats, talking and joking among themselves. It was not that long ago that Reese had been in a similar room, receiving the mission that would lead to the deaths of his SEAL troop, Army Rangers, and air crews on a dark Afghan mountain. The door at the front of the briefing room opened, and Reese immediately recognized the looming figure of Andy Danreb. The Chicago native missed nothing and nodded to Reese without breaking stride. His customary blue Oxford shirt was rolled up at the sleeves. He was ready to work. Nicole Fan was almost the polar opposite of the older, disgruntled Cold War relic. She was young, spry, and always chipper. Reese couldn't remember ever seeing her without a smile. Anyone who mistook her kindness for weakness, though, would soon find themselves on the losing end of an intellectual battle of wits. Born in America to a family who escaped Vietnam in 1975, she was one of the CIA's most talented targeters. After the fall of Saigon, her grandfather had blended in with the boat people as a refugee to escape the wrath of the NVA. She was not the first in her family with ties to U.S. intelligence. She caught Reese's eye and waved. Some might find it intimidating to stand up in a room surrounded by hardened special operators whose lives depend on the information presented. If Nicole felt that way, her demeanor did not betray it.
"Good evening, everyone," she began. "I'm Nicole Fan. I'm an SSO targeting officer from the CTC. This is Andy Danreb from the Russian desk at the Directorate of Analysis, formerly DI for those of you who remember.
Andy nodded, his haircut and stern look giving the impression that he may once have worn the uniform, even if it was 30 years and 40 pounds ago. At the mention of Russia, more than a few operators began to send questioning looks toward the front of the room.
This operation will be recognized as a special access program, so thank you for signing the NDAs earlier,
Nicole continued.
I know you all have a lot of practice.
She hit a button on the remote in her hand and a picture of a young woman filled the center screen.
This is Hannah Hastings, American citizen. She was kidnapped in Romania by what is suspected to be a rogue element of Russian intelligence. We believe she was moved overland through Moldova and into Ukraine, where her captors crossed into Russian-held territory. An unscheduled flight of an AN-26 transport departed Zavodska airfield in Crimea less than 24 hours later. The flight made two brief stops for fuel and terminated at Shoromi Naval Air Station, a remote base in Kamchatka, Russia.
A map detailing the flight appeared on the screen along with satellite imagery of the isolated but paved 3,000-meter runway.
This is Alexander Zharkov,
Nicole continued, advancing the slide to a file photo of the alleged perpetrator.
He is the deputy director of Directorate S in Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service. In layman's terms, he manages their illegals program, running agents without cover status, sometimes deep penetration programs, and other times simply sleeper agents. His father is this man, Ivan Zharkov.
A black-and-white photo of the mafia boss replaced that of his son. Andy nodded curtly and pointed to the screen. Ivan Zharkov. He's the Pakhan, or head, of the Tambov gang in the Bratva, also known as the Russian Mafia. When the Iron Curtain fell in 1991, it was chaos, but a select few saw opportunity, hence the rise of Russian organized crime. Ivan was more adept than most. He thought ahead and pushed one of his sons, Alexander, into the Foreign Intelligence Service. He wanted his own mole. We believe it was information from Alexander that allowed Ivan to crush his competition and consolidate power under the St. Petersburg Tambov gang. He used his son to orchestrate the arrest of rival gangs through Interpol. You may remember the arrests made headlines in Spain back in 2008. Dismantling a criminal network made Russia look strong in the eyes of the international community. They elevated Ivan Zharkov to the undisputed position of Vorvasakhon, a top authority for the Bratva, eliminating his rivals and making him the second richest man in Russia behind their president. Point being, Ivan is a long-term thinker and not someone to be trifled with. There are uncorroborated reports of a rift growing between Ivan and his son. Alexander was recalled from a posting in Belarus after he was tied to the murder of a prostitute. It was covered up, presumably through hush money from the elder, possibly by intimidation of the investigators by Bratva thugs. With newly acquired intelligence, Andy's eyes moved to Reese, I correlated the information we have on Alexander's postings with unsolved murders, and although the information is incomplete, the timing certainly suggests that Alexander Zharkov may be responsible for a series of murders around the globe. A series of crime scene photos moved across the screen, each one showing a young female.
Why not just turn all this over to Interpol? An operator built like a tank asked through a thick southern drawl.
Interpol has a surprisingly strong presence in Russia, but all that would do is tip Alexander off. If, and I say if, this mission gets the green light, you are her only chance.
Thank you, Andy,
Nicole said.
Alexander Zharkov left Moscow 36 hours ago on an AN-26 and landed at Shoromi Air Station earlier today. An hour later, an MI-8 took off from Medny Island, just east of the Kamchatka Peninsula. Medny is the smaller of two islands known as the Commander Islands and was all but abandoned in 2001. It's small, only about 71 square miles, but over the past 2 years, we have seen increased signs of military activity there.
Satellite imagery was projected of the island.
There is a bunker-like structure in addition to a larger metal building that houses vehicles. This summer, an array of structures was erected on various points of the island. Our theory, based on its proximity to Alaska, is that it is some type of radar or early warning site, but we can't be sure. We believe that Ms. Hastings was taken to the island and that she's still there. For how long, we don't know. We also believe that Alexander Zharkov is on the island with her.
A three-dimensional terrain model image of the island showed up on the screens.
To the best of our knowledge, this is the target structure. The CBs are almost finished with a mock-up for rehearsals, but remember, we have no intel on the interior layout.
Any other locations they may have taken her? Asked a man with the physique of a triathlete.
Ivan Zharkov has a dacha on the Black Sea where he doesn't spend much time. He also has a compound in central Siberia,
she said, bringing up a map of Russia and zooming in on an area in the middle.
It's located at the epicenter of the Tunguska event, of all places. He frequents it in the spring and fall, but we do not have any reports of Alexander accompanying his father there in quite some time.
Enemy situation?
Asked a laid-back-looking operator chewing gum in the second row.
Alexander is an odd one, Andy chimed in. He doesn't trust his own military or intelligence services, and instead has contracted security from the Wagner Group.
Heads nodded in recognition.
As a refresher, Andy continued, Wagner is a private military company. Think the Russian version of Blackwater.
Didn't they get tied to the killing of those journalists in the Central African Republic last year?
The same operator asked.
Yes, along with disappearances and suicides of more than a few in opposition to Putin's policies. They've been very active in Africa, specifically in CAR, Madagascar, Sudan, and Libya. They continue to grow in power and influence, propping up Russian-backed dictatorships in Venezuela, Syria, and elsewhere. We estimate that Alexander has 8 to 10 Wagner contractors on the island and possibly a personal bodyguard, but we can't be sure.
How well trained are they?
The Wagner rank and file are mostly filled with regular Russian army personnel who are trained up at a Wagner compound in the North Caucasus region of southern Russia. They do have a small special operations component for special activities who handle operations like targeting those journalists in Africa.
The inquisitive assaulter nodded like these were normal everyday occurrences in the life of being a commando. Which, in fact, they were.
The big question here is why? Asked Sergeant Major Holloway, verbalizing what they were all thinking.
I'll take that one, interjected Reese from the back of the room, making his way to the front.
Nicole and Andy stepped to the side to give him the floor.
I'm James Reese. I met most of you tonight. I'm a former SEAL currently working for Ground Branch, though I think we are supposed to call it something else these days.
The comment elicited a chuckle from a room full of people accustomed to senior-ranking officers renaming programs as a way to fill evaluations, insinuating that a highly successful established entity was entirely their idea before moving up the ladder in the chain of command.
Some of you may know Rafe Hastings, the former frogman continued. Heads nodded again. Hannah is his sister. She was abducted in retaliation for events last year in which Rafe and I were involved. Rafe has gone dark. Our last communication was from his sister's residence in Romania. I think he's on his way to Medni alone.
Shit, Holloway said, leaning forward in his chair. So what you're telling us is that we have two potential hostages in Russian territory.
And that's not all. Reese hesitated. Recent intel suggests that Alexander has moved on from his serial killing of prostitutes and is hunting humans on Medni Island. He's going to hunt Hannah, but her real purpose is bait. What he really wants is to hunt me and Rafe.
What? Holloway asked in disbelief. How reliable is this intel?
Reese thought of Dimitri in Thorne's cabin, the capsaicin flowing through his veins, cooking him from the inside out.
Very,
concluded Reese, not bothering to use the military terminology associated with source verification.
Holloway shook his head. This is a new one. Though it's not usually my place to ask, how will this be handled diplomatically?
Nicole stepped forward to take the question.
If approved, President Grimes would call the Russian president only if things went south. Insert and extract via MHX Blackhawks, she said, referring to the stealth helicopters made famous by the raid in Abbottabad. We have AKs and Russian ammo sourced in Russia to make the actions on the objective look like a rival gang hit. This needs to be non-attributable to U.S. forces. Fallout could be a house cleaning inside the Bratva. Off the record, I think the president will do little to downplay any rumors of U.S. involvement. He will be eager to show the world that he is not a puppet of Russia after all the accusations of Russian meddling in the last elections when he was the ticket VP.
Holloway stood up and looked at his watch before turning to address his men. Warno in 30 minutes. Time is of the essence on this one. It's going to be a long night. The next time you sleep, we might be on our way to Russia.
Chapter 58. Washington, D.C. Reginald Pine relished his role as gatekeeper to the president. One could say that the president of the United States was the world's most powerful figure, but in Pine's mind, the man who controlled access to the president held the real power. A soldier for most of his life, President Grimes was acutely susceptible to Pine's influence and manipulation. Not having been raised in the literal and figurative swamp that was Washington, D.C. Roger Grimes had spent a career as an Army officer and was selected as vice president to provide ideological balance to a ticket that would have otherwise leaned too far left for many of the nation's crucial swing states. With a decorated hero of the War on Terror by his side, the previous president cruised to an Electoral College victory. After Grimes was sworn in as vice president, he found that he was soon relegated to the background, rarely meeting with the president or his senior staff. It became clear that he had been mere arm candy during the campaign, and that the close advisory role that had been promised to the American people had been a facade. Grimes handled it like a professional and took it upon himself to focus on veterans' issues, appointing a commission to assess the VA healthcare system and then overseeing the implementation of its recommendations. Pine, a longtime Washington insider and former lobbyist, helped guide then Vice President Grimes through the morass of the federal government as he tried, mostly in vain, to advance the causes of those who had served their nation in uniform. The VP learned to trust Pine's political judgment and took his advice as he would that of an executive officer in the Army. For his part, Pine played the loyal soldier, biding his time for an opportunity to gain even greater influence. He couldn't care less about the VA. Those soldiers were stupid enough to volunteer knowing the risks. They were lucky to get free medical care for life. So what if they had to stand in line for a few hours? Pine found that the techniques from a book he'd read at Harvard on how to manipulate women into bed worked equally as well outside the realm of sexual coercion. Its methods helped him to influence and control both male and female politicians on policy issues. Sometimes he couldn't believe how easy it was. He'd started his professional lobbying career during a time when the tobacco industry was under attack. He'd learned that the old ways of throwing money at politicians and then threatening to support their opponents in the next election if they didn't stay on board didn't work the way they had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The opposition had organized and adapted. One had to play the game differently. There was no law against stupidity. If these idiots wanted to smoke and make the tobacco industry even more profitable, who was the government to stop them? Volenti non fit injuria. To a willing person, no injury is done. Besides, the U.S. government needed those tax dollars. How else were they to pay for a cradle-to-grave welfare state? He'd successfully delayed a 2006 court order mandating that tobacco companies advertise the ill effects of smoking. The government was forcing private companies of a legally available product to spend their hard-earned profits to undermine their own business.